Welcome to Just an Average Citizen, the podcast that helps to educate, inform, and empower you to make an impact in Abilene and the Big Country. I'm really excited to do this episode with you. This is part two of Book by the Bite with the Toxic War on Masculinity. And I think this is going to be worth your time. It might be a little bit longer. I thought I had split the book in half, but there's a couple of chapters extra in this side that wasn't in the first part. So we'll see how I can squeeze it in. But I'm so glad you decided to join me to be willing to expose yourself to some of the cultural battles that are going on in the Big Country that we're facing right now. Thank you for subscribing and sharing this with your family and friends so they too can be informed of what's going on here in the Big Country. A lot of times we read these books and we think about what's going on in terms of somewhere else, but we don't always recognize what's happening here in Abilene, Texas, and it's going on. And there is this next book that I'm going to review after this one will be very important for us to understand literally what's taking place in our city. So I hope that you'll start to learn that this is a place where you can find information and resources to recognize the signs of the time and be able to see what is going on, not just in terms of how you've always thought life is, because it is forever changing. And there are some very intentional things going on that are meant to confuse us because they feel familiar as of days gone by, but they're completely different and everything's changed in how they use definitions and words like that. So let's continue on this journey with the Toxic War on Masculinity and see what we can learn about how we can take back the God intended versions of male and female. Okay, so we're starting on chapter 6. Are women superior when women were put on a pedestal? Why was the home so sentimental in the 19th century, and how did it affect the cultural construction of masculinity? As we've seen, society was split into public versus private realm. If you remember the fact value split where we had the public sphere on the bottom tier where everything was allowed, if it was fact-based, and anything personal, religious, or spiritual was put in the private sphere where you weren't allowed to really talk about it. So science became the only basis for what we could communicate things, where religion and God was put into your private places where you weren't allowed to bring them, into governmental places, schools, the public of any nature, without being told that's not appropriate. Okay, so we have people still desperately wanted to maintain the values that were being scrubbed out of the public sphere, things like kindness, affection, altruism, self-sacrifice, and religious piety. And if there's no place for them in the public sphere, where would they be cultivated? In the private sphere. So here's a picture of that where we have women, the values of women was private, and the values of the facts of men was public. So it says, for if women were held responsible for upholding moral and spiritual standards, and the role seemed to give them to the duty to admonish men for their bad behavior, women's criticism grew increasingly harsh and self-righteous, sometimes sounding eerily similar to the condemnation of the men that we hear today. So what happened was, is men went to work, and they were given a whole new world to have to navigate. And then coming back home, the women were like, okay, we've got to instill these values in you, and you're not living up, and you're not measuring up. And it became sort of this unhealthy, toxic relationship, because women were never supposed to be the value holders. Men and women are both supposed to hold value and instill value in our culture. And so it kind of gave men this exit of not having to really have values or set a standard of integrity and things like that, because the women were faced with this task, which was unhealthy and unbalanced, and made women sound like, you know, the nags and the critics and the harshness, which is now what's led to, you know, this feminism and this war on the toxic war on masculinity. It's like, as soon as you see it, you're like, oh, it makes so much sense. But sometimes we don't recognize these things until it's put right in front of us. So instead of setting women up as the moral guardians of society, a more biblical response would have been to stand against the secularization of the public sphere. So instead of women saying, okay, we will be the moral guardians, they should have said, wait a minute, that's not supposed to be private. This is all supposed to be part of the public sphere. Let's get values back into the public sphere to oppose the drive to make it value-free. And instead of allowing secular philosophies To prevail in the public realm, Christians should have developed a robust apologetic capable of defending a biblical philosophy of economics and politics. They should have asserted that Christianity is a holistic truth that applies to all of life, but as churches accepted the sacred secular split, they largely capitulated to the privatizing of religion and the secularizing of the public sphere. So as we've learned, what's happened is the public sphere is not void of religion, it's just been replaced with secular religion, humanism, critical theories, Marxism, communism, all those religions, which I know those are some of the way governments operate, but in some ways they're aspects of a religious indoctrination that's been happening. And so instead of the church saying, wait a minute, we're not going to have this separate spheres, we're going to put it back in, we kind of just acquiesce and go, oh, that makes sense. And, you know, we didn't want to be, I mean, I don't know, I haven't really talked to anyone when this happened because they're all dead, but it's like they just didn't want to cause problems and they thought it made sense that, you know, if it's religious, it's private and you get to choose what you want to do for your life. But if it's public, it should be secular, which secularism is just as much a religion as Christianity. And so we bought into this lie that it was fair and okay and justified. And it's been problematic ever since. Notice, however, the strategy does not actually challenge the secularization of the public realm. It merely seeks to compensate for the loss of values in the public realm by cultivating them in the private realm. Feminist writer Barbara Ehrenreich calls the strategy of separate spheres a fatal moral compromise. Why? Because it chose not to remake the world, to demand the women make up for it. So it didn't remake it. It said, okay, women, we're going to change this up. And now you're solely responsible for coming up with the lack that we've created because of how we resituated how public and private areas are. The ideology of domesticity was really a form of sentimentalism. It gave the people the opportunity to profess devotion to ethics and morality very convincingly without actually changing or challenging any of the secular worldviews. Do you get that? It didn't change anything and it didn't challenge anything. It just made women have to make up for it at the home. And now what we can see is it didn't work. And so now the schools are like, oh my gosh, that didn't work. So now we're having to take over in the schools what the parents failed to do because we've separated God from the majority of our culture. And we're like trying to scramble to figure out how to replace that. I'm sorry, it said challenging in the secular worldviews that were shaping the world of politics and economics. In short, the sacred secular split let men off the hook. As morality was privatized, men were relieved of the responsibility to apply a Christian worldview in the public realm. So they had their work realm, their work worldview, and their home one, and the two should never meet. And now we're suffering the consequences of generations of this being the norm for how they operate. Why was the function of the mother so romanticized? Because the Industrial Revolution was removing women's economically productive work out of the home. From spinning thread to sewing clothes to canning food, the ways that women had contributed economically to the household were gradually transferred to factories. And as women's economically productive work dwindled, their emotional work became more salient. A mother was called to stoke the fires of affection, to minister to her world-weary husband, and to impress moral sentiments on the hearts of her children. A mother's work in the home was not considered real work because it no longer contributed economically to the family's sustenance. Instead, it was a labor of love. Yet for that reason, it was all the more sanctified. So we took out the economic contribution of women out of the home and put them in factories and then left women with very little to do and made them have to be do the labor of love. And so that became more altruistic and more important, but all for the wrong reasons, because it was never meant to be solely the woman's responsibility. It was both man and woman to bring that into the home, and we allowed that to be separated, and now women feel unsatisfied and unfulfilled in their life because part of what they were created to do has been taken out. And so we'll see more of the consequences of this here in a little bit. But in the Victorian age, angels began to be portrayed as young women, delicate, sweet, and guardian little children. Brown concludes, one of the great mystic transformations of the earliest 19th century was the feminization of angels, which that is so revolutionary to me because, again, when you talk about the Michael, when you talk about Michael, he's a warrior. And he's defending and taking on the things of God. And then what do you see most angels? They're like, draped in flowy fabric with, you know, wispy hair and nothing of a warrior. And so that's part of the of what the Victorian age did, is feminized angels, because they wanted that to be something that was associated with women. The beauty and the value of things that our society needed was associated with women, and men no longer had any images created to reflect that they actually were supposed to be contributing to that as well. As the late 18th century philosopher Immanuel Kant was arguing that men were the rational sex and therefore the more effective moral actors, in his view, women were incapable of acting on moral principles at all. Women knew nothing of duty, nothing of compulsion, nothing of obligation. I hardly believe that the fair sex is capable of principles, but in place of it, Providence has put in their breast kind and benevolent sensations. How demeaning. In essence, America was losing the biblical conviction that maleness itself, as God created it, is intrinsically good, that being moral and virtuous are inherent to the male identity. For the first time in history, Rotundo writes, women took men's place as the custodians of communal virtue, but in so doing so, they were freeing men to pursue self-interest. Man, and how disengaging is it for a man whose purpose is to protect, provide, and serve, when his purpose is taking away and now he's just out to make money? Like, that has totally shifted the value that has been placed on his life. And again, it makes him feel purposeless, as it does to women. And so men and women have both been struggling because they've been divided in who they were created to be, because society has secularized what has gone on in the public and private sphere. Okay, let me keep going because I know there's a lot to cover. As a historian, Jane Rendell explains, leaders of the revivals preached a religion of the heart, and the qualities of the reborn Christian, as opposed to the merely nominal Christian, were qualities that have been described as quintessentially female, humble and submissive, self-denying, obedient and passive. Or as Sarah Hale put it at the time, to bring about the true Christian civilization, the men must become more like women and the women more like angels. Ugh. Can you see how that did not go well for us? They feminized angels and then say, now the women have to be more like the angels and the men have to be more like the women. Oh, how toxic was that? How toxic was that? Instead, many churchmen went into retreat. They stopped making cognitive claims for Christianity that could be defended with reasoned arguments in the public sphere. And let me pause here. I mean, apologetics is such a key thing that most of the church does not understand. Now, there's a lot more I can go into that, but we have lost the art of understanding why we do what we do, why our faith matters to us, why it is the truth. And we've come into the age where their feelings is very prevalent, and it's really disabled us to be able to stand on conviction, because when someone comes with a feeling that makes more sense, then we're so easily swayed because we don't have that truth. And I thought I was very grounded in it till I started having questions for my children that I couldn't answer. And I realized, why is it that way? And I realized how weak my understanding of my faith was. And so it took some time for me to begin slowly rebuilding that up and bringing truth into the picture, so that the truth preceded me, so that when the lies came against whatever the culture was offering, so when the culture brought their lies, the truth was already almost like girding me up to be prepared for the battle ahead. Whereas I feel like so many of us have lost the sword that is our weapon. It's the word of God, and it is to defend and it is so powerful. And I think we had it on our body, but we didn't understand its power. And so it was not used the way it was supposed to. It was more like to be a menacing threat rather than an ability to engage in the battle with the lies of the culture, if that makes sense. Okay, so let's go here. Instead, they transferred Christianity to the private sphere of experience and feelings. In short, they retreated even further into the sacred secular divide. An emotional, maybe that's it. It's like we have the sword as our weapon to war against the lies of the culture, but the culture has said, oh, wait, that's not appropriate here. Keep your sword, keep it in its sheath, because it's not appropriate to use it here. You only can use that in the church to battle church issues. And I think it's made us feel like we have nothing to stand on because we've put away the only weapon we've been given to battle the lies of the culture. Anyway, that's just a little revelation I had. As an emotional approach was especially pronounced in churches that were growing liberal in their theology, Liberal theologians were in the process of giving much of the intellectual content of historic Christianity, especially anything to do with the supernatural, such as miracles, the incarnation, the resurrection, and divine revelation. As a result, liberal theologians instead insisted that a proper emotional response, oh, here it goes, was more important than correct doctrine. Man, that made us so impotent. And because women were stereotypically thought to be more emotional, liberal churchmen were especially eloquent in the heralding women as the keepers of religion. Okay, do you hear that shift? So now it's not only are women the keepers of values and morality, but now they're the keepers of religion. So if that belongs to the women, where do the men fit in religion? There is no place for men. And that's why men have lost their desire to go to church, because there is no place for them, because we have, in our attempt to be more culturally relevant, I think is really as simple as it could be, we've emasculated it to where it is very feminized, and there is no place for the good man, like we talked about in the last part. Okay. What happens when the ladies are given responsibility for raising the standard of character among men? Well, we know that women are not men. We cannot raise the standard of character for men. Men have to do that for themselves, and men have to do that for other men.
What happens when the ladies are given responsibility for raising the standard of character among men when they are assigned to be the custodians of virtue? The answer, we have seen it, is that men are freed up to become less responsible. They are let off the hook. People begin to describe men as morally hardened and spiritually insensitive. What America needs, Stanton concluded, is a new evangel of womanhood to exalt purity, virtue, morality, true religion, to lift man up into the higher realms of thought and action. The word evangel means gospel, so Stanton was preaching a religion of feminism. Ooh, that's scary. So, sorry, I didn't clarify. This was feminist leader Elizabeth Cady Stanton used equally censorious language to condemn men. So she said that we need womanhood. The new evangel of womanhood is to exalt purity, morality, true religion, to lift up man. Women are responsible for lifting up men to higher realms. Men are not responsible. Women are. And so she was preaching feminism, right? Because it's up to the women to take care of it all. And that's never been a biblical worldview. Eventually, religion became so closely connected to femininity, that as historian Callum Brown writes, male piety was depicted as a sacrifice of innate masculinity. To act as a Christian, it seemed that men had to deny their masculine nature to leave it at the door of the church. That can't go wrong at all, right? Augustine gives a good description of servant leadership. Even those who rule serve those who seem to command, for they rule not from love of power, but from a sense of duty they owe to others, not because they are proud of authority, but because they love mercy. That is powerful. How many men are in powerful positions because of the influence it gives them, not because the duty they owe to others? And again, I don't even think we can even disparage men at this point, because it's been so ingrained in our culture that you are to be in authority, you have power, not that you owe your duty to others. You're proud of your authority because you love mercy. That is the most unmasculine or effeminate statement you can make, that men love mercy. That doesn't make sense in my brain. And even I've read this book multiple times, and I know what we're trying to say here. I'm just saying that it's crazy how far we've come because of our culture. And we didn't even realize what we were giving up when we gave it up at the time, because it sounded appropriate. It sounded like, you know, cutting edge, and it made more sense for us to pursue this femininity more than it made sense to pursue the biblical truth. Now we're to 7. Hopefully I'll go faster through this. This is going to be a little long. Historians sometimes ask why it took a woman to break the silence of American novelists of the evils of slavery. The answer is that once women had been put on a moral pedestal, they resolved to use their position to address societal ills. So they were the keepers of morality. They were the guardians of virtue, so then they had to be the one to stop slavery. They announced they could not fulfill their commission to guard the home unless they exported the values of the home to the outside world. So now the women are the responsible for bringing the private to the public. It's broken, it's fractured, and now it cannot go well because it's not coming out as a whole biblical worldview. It's coming in the fractured, cultural, approved worldview that is acceptable. So after all, it's impossible to hermetically seal off the private from the public sphere. Public vices have private consequences. All families are affected, even if indirectly, by drunkenness, poverty, prostitution, and violence. Therefore, women argued that they had a duty to go out into public realm to shut down taverns, salons, brothels, and gambling houses. Their efforts inspired an enormous flowering of reform movements, a network so massive that historians refer to it collectively as the Benevolent Empire. Though these movements did good work in addressing social evils, eventually they created sexual antagonism between men and women. Why? Because many of them addressed what were primarily male vices. As historian Mary Ryan points out, almost all the female reform associations were implicit condemnations of males. There was little doubt as to the sex slave of masters, tavern keepers, drunkards, and seducers. They were not always careful to distinguish between men's moral failings and men's intrinsic identity. They should no longer be deprived of the tempering influence of women's compassion, spirituality, and moral sensitivity. This language gave birth to the inflammatory rhetoric denouncing men that continues to our day. Man, so when women are the guardians, guess whose vices get attacked first? It's the men's. And are we attacking the women's vices? Probably not as much that I can tell. Christianity thus completes and fulfills all earlier notions of what it means to be a man. What was new about Christianity, notes Stearns, is that gentleness, love, compassion were virtues. Masculine virtues. Christianity praised men, in fact, who had many of the virtues more commonly assigned to women. Men were called to be whole persons, reflecting the whole image of God. How empowering must that be to have that restored? I mean, I know what it meant for me to restore my femininity by not having to be equal to men, to not having to prove that I can do it just like the men. That restored my wholeness. I can only imagine what it would do to a man to recognize that virtues that he is given by his creator were intentional, and they are not feminine. They are actually masculine. But after the Industrial Revolution, the language describing the male character changed. They began to be criticized as greedy and self-interested. As the public sphere was secularized, Christian morality was increasingly relegated to the private sphere. Since women still worked in the private sphere, they were assigned the task of keeping the spiritual flame alight. Men were criticized as rude, crude, and lewd. The original Sunday schools were created for children who worked at the factory 6 days a week, the poorest of the poor. The goal was to help these children climb out of poverty by teaching them reading, writing, arithmetic, Bible, and catechism. And catechism is just a fancy word for saying the tenets of our faith. So Sunday schools weren't about teaching necessarily just the Bible. It was about teaching them reading, writing, and arithmetic to the poor kids who were not able to go to school during the week. Isn't that interesting? Something we don't remember very often. In the reform societies of the benevolent empire, women typically outnumbered men. They argued that their experience in managing a household gave them skills and character needed for the wider sphere of public activism. So isn't that interesting? The women were stripped of their economic contribution to society, so they picked up this labor of love mentality, and then that qualified them to be the ones who could be active about or be activist in the public sphere, telling society what was good and bad and what they needed to do. It sounds a little like what Eve pursued in the garden, is that she wanted the knowledge and the power to be greater than, or to be something that she was not created to be. And it sounds like we have been doing that even now in our current society, and we don't even recognize how toxic that is to so many aspects of our lives. So I hope this is enlightening you. I hope this is challenging you to recognize that, you know, there are some cultural things that are even within the church that are not biblical, and that we can break free of them and actually find the freedom and the fulfillment that God offers us through His truth. The impact of these women's groups was so great that a prominent reformer at the time, Judge Ben Lindsay, said, "Scarcely without exception, it has been the members of the women's club who have championed ever good law and secured the passage of nearly all the advanced legislation for the protection of the home and the children." Here they are, they're the guardians, they're doing the great thing, while men, you know, you're just to have all these vices that we're having to eliminate because you're just so inept to be able to function in society without us limiting your freedom so that we, the guardians of everything holy, can be in charge. And that doesn't work well for anyone. We all lose when that is the mentality of how our culture operates. The famous novelist Henry James even complained that women were taking control of the entire cultural realm. In his words, while the American man was devoting himself single-mindedly to the business, the American woman had established peerless possession of culture, of learning, art, literature, and social life. The American woman, James warned, has conquered the globe. History books often give the impression that women who drove this network of reform movements were early feminists, and some were the first wave feminists, but the majority were not. They did not advance the feminist argument that they are not important, that there are no important differences between men and women. Just the opposite. They accepted the separate spear doctrines that women are more loving, pious, and compassionate than men. And they argued that it was precisely those unique qualities that equipped them for benevolent work beyond the home. Public drunkenness became a problem on city streets. In Manhood in America, sociologist Michael Kimmel writes, Americans drank more, far more, hard alcoholic beverages between 1790 and 1830 than any other time in our history before or since. Sex became commodified for a mass audience, including pornography and a striptease show. The number of brothels increased, as did the number of illegitimate births. As historian Carl Degler explains, the saloon was a man's world, one in direct competition with the home. Thus, the temperance movement was an attempt to get husbands out of the taverns and back into the family hearth where they belonged. The very fact that women had to step up to right society's wrong was cited as evidence. So the very culture that was created by privatizing religion into the private sphere and keeping secularism in the public sphere, which created the unbalance between women economically, well, and the industrial revolution, you know, but the economic changes made in women the guardians of the home and men just these guys that went to work and earned money. That was all they were good for. They had no ability to have virtue because that was a feminized part of the culture. And so the very people that created this unhealthy society then said that now men were morally incompetent and compromised. I mean, how can this be? How can we have let this happen? I'm shocked and disgusted that I didn't even recognize this until, thankfully, Nancy Piercy introduced this idea to me so that now I understand why so many things are wrong. And it started with the destruction of the family way back in the Industrial Revolution by separating men and women into these totally different, unconnected worlds that had never happened up until that point. Okay, essentially women were accusing men of having failed to curb these social evils on their own. Now we women are going to take over and show you how it's done. That can't go wrong. In 1890, a Presbyterian minister went so far as to say the reason women wanted the vote was to re-Christianize the public square. Okay, so now this even goes off the charts even more. We needed to be able to vote so we could re-Christianize the public square because the men were clearly incompetent to be able to vote the right values and people into power. What a travesty. Their error seems to be not the securing of more politics into religion, but of more religion into politics. He was right. Or as a feminist journalist Gail Collins puts it, that for reformers, the bottom line was forcing men to behave. Okay, again, I have learned that that doesn't go well for us in any sphere, for the men or the women. The argument that the nation needed women to infuse society with the values of the home and family assumed a troubling premise. However, namely, that men could no longer be relied on to champion family values. How emasculating! American society was acquiescing to the idea that men had become crude and corrupt. It was lowering the expectations of men, and then we beat them up because they don't do anything. But we've lowered our expectations, and they've settled into this impossible task of overcoming this problem of low expectations. Again, not everyone is this way, but I'm just saying this is how society behaved as a whole. But when women are set up as the conscience of men, bad idea, over time, it can cause resentment. Hello? Note the amazing image from the temperance movement on the facing page. The women are kneeling and praying in the street, reinforcing the idea that religion is for women, while the men eye them resentfully from the door of the windows of the saloon. The tension is palpable. So here you see it. It was on this page. I actually had it. I'm pointing to it like you can see me point to it. The women are out there praying, and the men are like, oh, you're just taking away the fun. You're just the wet blanket in our life. That cannot create a healthy environment for any family to thrive. Okay, a study by historian Callum Brown found a large proportion of evangelical stories about men centered on the destruction of families by male evils. The plots were predictable. Women's problems were the result of men who were drinkers, gamblers, abusers, and womanizers. As Brown concludes, nowhere did evangelical literature have such a powerful influence in the public domain as in its demonization of men.
That is a horrible reflection and a horrible twisting that that is not a biblical worldview, that we demonize men because women are the guardians of all things good and holy. I mean, how could this ever go anywhere but down? The condemnation of males was hugely insulting to men. It was offensive and patronizing. It is crucial not to equate men's sin with their essential nature. Men needed to be reminded that God created them to be loving and responsible husbands and fathers and leaders of the community. That is their authentic identity, and living it out will ultimately give them genuine fulfillment. If men are constantly attacked for their sin, they will lose sight of their original God-given purpose. Since women did not yet have the right to vote, it was men who passed the 18th Amendment establishing prohibition in 1919. That means a significant number of men shared women's concern about destructive effects of excessive drinking, enough to pass a constitutional amendment outlawing the manufacture and sale of alcohol. Finally, it was men who granted the women the right to vote with the passage of the 19th Amendment in 1920. Once again, clergy led the way. A historian observes that there were hundreds of ministers who made their churches available for suffragists to deliver their lectures and who preached in favor of it. Wait a minute. Did you catch that? Many churches allowed women to talk about the politics of being able to vote in the churches. So again, there's so much disinformation or misinformation about history that we have been fed a lie here in Abilene. In Abilene, we believe that there should be nothing going like this on between the churches and anything governmental, but yet this is our history. This is how things came to be, and yet now we've isolated the largest group of voting people because we want to tell them that politics is dirty and they can't talk about it. And I know that's a side topic and we'll move on, but I'm just saying, like, there's so much that has been separated to our demise. And if we don't learn how to rejoin them and bring them back into their wholeness, we're going to continue suffering the effects of this into possibly the demise of our nation. Instead of accusing men of being toxic, a better strategy to support their innate sense of what it means to be a better strategy is to support their innate sense of what it means to be good man, the good man. Christian men who hold a biblical ideal for manhood will be able to better resist the pressure to conform to the secular definition of the real man. The high view of women that emerged in the 19th century would have not been possible without the seeds that were planted in the New Testament right from the beginning, and the Christian men seeking godly way to relate women to women today, and the most compelling model should be Jesus's actions. The fact that the early church prohibited abortion and infanticide was one reason women flocked to Christianity. Today, people who oppose abortion are accused of being anti-woman. But in the ancient world, people recognized that to reject abortion is to be pro-woman. In the ancient world, they recognize this, and yet we can't even recognize it at all. My daughter is doing, you know, a Lincoln Douglas debate, and she's talking about history and as a value, what do we gain from it? We repeat the mistakes of our past if we don't know it. And this is a clear explanation of how the past has been obfuscated to the point where we don't recognize what Christianity offers women. It is pro-women. It is not anti-women. Like, the secular world would want us to believe, like the humanist and the Marxist would want us to believe, that that Christianity oppresses women, that the Western way of life is oppressive to women. It actually is some of the most free places for women to exist. A conversation for another day. But the church's opposition to abortion and infanticide communicated that Christians cherish the female contribution to bringing new life into the world. They treated women's uniquely female role and function with respect. Most revolutionary after his death, Jesus entrusted the message of his resurrection to women in a world where the testimony of women was not even allowed in court. The Jewish historian Josephus wrote, "Let not the testimony of women be admitted on the account of the levity and boldness of their sex." When the Industrial Revolution took fathers out of the home, what happened to boys? The short answer is they began to be raised by women. How did that affect their sense of masculinity? Let's talk about that and find out. 8, the wild child, how the Industrial Revolution created fatherless boys. This is so powerful.
Over time, boys began to resist the feminine guidance. They began to associate rules and structure with femininity. They pushed back by creating a new idol of boyhood that being a real boy meant being rude, rowdy, rebellious, and rule-breaking. They created what historians have dubbed boy culture. And there's nothing on that one. Okay. As children lost that masculine influence, mothers had little choice but to fill in the gap. But boys could see for themselves that adult male culture was quite different from female culture. And therefore, asking a boy to adhere to his mother's rules seemed to be asking him to be effeminate. For a boy, writes historian Mark Carnes, it seemed he could fulfill the moral demands made by his mother only by sacrificing his status as a man. Men began to feel that to retrieve a sense of robust manhood, they needed to escape from women and the home and even from civilization itself. Many of those fiction writers were skillful at their craft and wrote engaging stories, yet it is important to recognize that they were promoting a new theme, that the way to become a real man was leaving family and community behind for a life that was wild, unfettered, and free. As literary critic Leslie Fielder writes, ever since Rip Van Winkle, the typical male protagonist of our American fiction has been a man on the run, harried into the forest or out to the sea, down to the river or into combat, anywhere to avoid civilization, marriage, and responsibility. Fielder concludes, it is this retreat to nature and childhood that makes our literature and life so charmingly and infuriatingly boyish. In other words, this male-centric fiction was a continuation of boy culture. In these novels, the heroes were not men acting out boyhood fantasies of escaping to the frontier, the wilderness, or high seas. They were Christian men who found home life happy, and satisfying, and who were eager to contribute to it. Like men in the colonial age, the characters in these novels continue to treat the direction of the household as the highest human art. They still treated marriage and home as central to the male identity. And so it's really interesting to note these differences in the writers and what they found satisfying in life. Michael Kimmel, sociology professor at Stony Brook University, writes, as a genre, the Western represented the apotheosis of masculinist fantasy. The vast prairie is the domain of a male liberation from workplace humiliation, cultural feminization, and domestic emasculation. The saloon replaces the church, the campfire replaces the Victorian parlor, and the range replaces the factory floor. The Western is purified, pristine male dominion. Because civilized morality was equated with Christian morality, Westerns were often marked by anti-religious undertone. The typical plot line, says literary critic Jane Tompkins, is the transformation of men who have been enfeebled by the doctrines of a feminized Christianity. Of course, Westerns have many positive features, which is why they have enduring appeal. For all their protest against conventional religion and morality, Westerns portray their heroes as natural gentlemen with an impeccable ethic and a firm sense of natural law. They are tough guys who fight for justice. They have daring and skill. They protect women and children. Yet instead of escaping into boy culture, more biblical response would have been to recognize that Christianity does not strip away the virtues of boyhood. The natural drive many boys have to fight, to compete, to build forts, to win. Instead, it calls men to direct those masculine traits to fight evil, overcome sin, protect those they love, and strategize how to advance biblical truth in the world. Christianity does not suppress men's thirst for risk and adventure, but redirects it to eternal goals. Clearly, the male fiction writers of the 19th century were not drawing from real life. They were influenced by the Romantic movement and its myth of the noble savage, the stereotype of indigenous people as naturally good, not corrupted by civilization. The word savage did not yet have any negative connotations. Native American men were praised for being closer to nature, which was thought to give them traits like courage, fierceness, bravery, and independence, virtues said to be lost in the over-civilized Western society. As a result, the noble savage became a popular literary stocked character. It was associated with the writings of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who taught that people were naturally good and were only corrupted by society. Do you know the lie in that? It's not society that corrupts man. Man is corrupted from the beginning and needs the salvation of God to rescue him from his corruption and his sin. That's the only redemption that man can find in this world, not in moving away from society. The solution, therefore, was to escape society by stripping away the constraints of custom, convention, tradition, and propriety. There we go. The male novelist of the 19th century played on Rousseau's idealized troupe to inspire men who felt smothered by middle-class urban life and who longed for adventure. But what they offered was little more than a bourgeois fantasy. Seton presented scouting as a solution to over-civilization. He complained that the industrial world had turned robust, mainly self-reliant boyhood into a lot of flat-chested cigarette smokers with shaky nerves and doubtful vitality. The 1914 Boy Scout Manual explained the purpose of the organization. The wilderness is gone. The buckskin man is gone. The painted Indian has hit the trail over the Great Divide. The privations and hardships of pioneer life, which did so much to produce sterling manhood, are now but legend. And we must depend on the Boy Scout movement to produce the men of the future. Today, few people remember that scouting was also originally framed as a means of liberating boys from the world of women. A 1914 article distributed by the Boy Scouts argued that at a certain age, a boy slips the apron strings and discovers a world in which petticoats are scorned and an attempt at petticoat rule is resented. As one historian explained, scouting was intended to be a boy's liberation movement to free young males from women, especially from mothers. How far has it fallen? It does not offer that anymore. Boy Scouts celebrated a masculinity test against the proved in the world of nature and other men far from the restraints of home, hearth, school, and church. Scouting was enlisted in a crusade to rescue boys from their mothers and reunite them from a viral ideal. And again, I still think that it tried to take away something, it tried to offer something good, but it did it the wrong way. Just like, you know, putting women as guardians of virtue. That was an attempt to do something good, but it failed. And again, trying to cut the apron strings from mother or women was not healthy because it was the wrong escape. You're escaping from the wrong things. Why did so many people embrace the myth of the noble savage? Why did they think the way to help boys grow into men was to act out pre-Christian rituals derived from Native American cultures? Why did so many think our Christian heritage no longer had the resources to help boys mature into strong, confident, courageous men? They looked to the lost prehistoric past to explain what has gone wrong with civilized manhood. But once again, why do these men think the best way to get in touch with their authentic self is to turn to pre-Christian cultures? Why don't they think Christianity offers resources for developing genuine manhood? Why do they think that getting away from their family and becoming a wild man is the way to recover a healthy masculinity? As a result, Bly focuses on men's need to heal from their father wound, the grief and loss men feel when their fathers were not present for them emotionally or physically. In his word, the love unit most damaged by the Industrial Revolution is the father-son bond. At Bly's all-male retreats, men have the opportunity to experience communion with other wounded men who are also grieving the loss of their fathers. Grieving one's father wound can be therapeutic, but the best way to heal is not by retreating into the woods with other men. It is by discovering there is a supernatural father whose love is far more powerful than any human love. In Healing the Masculine Soul, Gordon Dalby writes, "No pain in this world strikes more deeply into the boy's heart than being abandoned emotionally or physically by dad. No pain, therefore, stirs more directly in a man his need for the saving power of Father God." If genuine manhood is found by detaching from his home, the implication is being connected to a home goes against man's true nature. If men buy into that message, it will undercut their incentives to commit to marriage and family. Christianity calls men to develop this kind of courage. The way to achieve godly manhood is not to escape responsibility, but to embrace it. To carry responsibility for others is a task that requires the full scope of manly virtues, from mystery and enterprise to care and tenderness. Yet in the 19th century, as Western society grew more secular, men gradually lost the sight of biblical pattern for manhood. When Charles Darwin's theories of evolution became popular, many men embraced an evolutionary vision of man as wild and barbarian, little more than beast under a threw veneer of civilization. Darwinism normalized many traits today that are labeled toxic, as we will discover in the next chapter. So now we're to your chapter 9, your inner barbarian, when Americans embrace the secular guy code. Ultimately, the attempt to make women the moral reformers of man was self-defeating. Why? Because men grew weary of being portrayed as villains. Men began to cast the reform movement as moralistic and emasculating. Male fiction writers glorified men who had escaped the ties of marriage and family, who had shaken off feathers of civilization to get in touch with their inner cowboy. In this chapter, we reach a key turning point. Men took the condemnations that women had been lobbing against them and turned them into badges of pride. They agreed that men are naturally crude, competitive, and combative, but they transformed them from negative traits into normative ones, into characteristics of real man. Recall that men in the 19th century had grown concerned about over-civilization and were seeking ways to bolster a sense of masculinity. Social Darwinism came in handy in several ways. Take militarism. If life evolved through the struggle for survival, then applying that principle to the nations suggests that way to produce strong, vigorous manhood is through warfare. Social Darwinism was also used to support a sports and fitness craze that swept over a nation toward the end of the 19th century. As middle-class Americans left behind rigorous life on the farm to become a nation of sedentary office workers, they began to turn to sports and exercise to rebuild their physical health. The first tennis court in the United States was built in 1876, the first basketball court in 1891. Sports were touted not as a way to get physically fit, but also as a way for boys to reconnect with their evolutionary origins. In 1866, the German biologist Ernst Haeckel, a devotee of Darwin, proposed a theory called recapitulation. There we go. Sorry, got to get the syllables right. Claiming that each human embryo replaces the entire history of evolution from a one-celled organism to fish to amphibian to mammal to human. Social Darwinists concluded that boys continue the process of evolution by recapitulating the history of the human race as they pass from childhood to adulthood. Haeckel's theory of recapitulation was eventually discredited. He had supported this theory with falsified sketches of embryos. Already in his own day, he was accused of fraud, as is most of the things that people promote these days. If you just look a little bit deeper, you'll find that most of the culturally relevant pushes are all based on lies. Yet the idea that humans arose from like gender identity, gender theory, gender identity, queer theory, Marxism, what else do we have? Socialism, communism. I mean, you just pick it, you name it. Transgender, you know, children are sexual from birth, Kinsey, you know, Seekus, all these things. They're all based on lies. Yet the idea that humans arose from animal origins and are barbarians at the heart was becoming part of the socially constructed definition of manhood. Stephen Crane's The Red Badge of Courage, often assigned in high school classes, is set during the Civil War. Early in the novel, the main character, Henry, flees from the field of battle, but later he felt the daring spirit of a savage. He redeems himself by fighting like a barbarian, a beast, a war devil. Jack London is best known for the books like The Call of the Wild, 1903, but what most people don't know, as a young man, London underwent what historians called a conversion experience to radical naturalism by reading books about evolution. He even memorized passages from Darwin's books and could quote them by heart the way Christians memorize scripture. Like earlier male novelists, the literary naturalist treated the wild wilderness as an arena where men could reaffirm their masculinity. As one historian explains, the wilderness was seen as a source of virility, toughness, and savagery, qualities that defined fitness in Darwinian terms. The secular script for manhood was redefined as crude and combative, governed by biological instincts for lust and power. Many of the literary naturalists created rollicking adventure stories that were great fun to read. One of our sons devoured the Tarzan books, but Christians should always read with the worldview antennae posed to pick up the story's underlying message. A Darwinian worldview furthered secular ideas of what it meant to be a man. The earlier ideal of Christian gentlemen had urged men to live up to the image of God and planted in them. By contrast, the Darwinian worldview urged men to live down to their presumed animal nature. So lower those expectations. You're just animalistic, which makes sense on how they behave so much these days, because that's what they're told they're supposed to be. To compete in the ruthless struggle for dominance and power, the real man was being defined in increasingly toxic terms. All right, the lesson of evolution, which there is a book coming up, if I can get to it, that talks about how this is so, science has been used to lie to us for so long that evolution is a theory. It's not a law. There's nothing to back it up. And yet that's what schools teach.
That's what everyone teaches, that evolution is how we have become who we are. The lesson of evolution apparently was that men are brutal beasts and that women must appease and placate them while learning to hide their resentment of ill treatment. Many leading scientists of the day agreed with Darwin that women were less evolved than men. Anthropologist James McGregor Allen held that physically, mentally, and morally, women is kind of an adult child. Thomas H. Huxley, whose fierce defense of Darwinism earned him a moniker Darwin's Bulldog, and said even education could not lift women to intellectual equality with men. Since women's inferior abilities were a product of natural selection, he argued they were not likely to be removed by even the most skillfully conducted educational selection. There was no hope, apparently, for women to escape their inferior position. Darwinism thus gave impetus to the male revolt against the home and family, in fact, against any transcendent values that would call men to higher ideal, to a biblical standard of behavior. Who must civilize these raging beasts? You guessed it. Women. According to Gilder, an unmarried man is poor and neurotic. He is disposed to criminality, drugs, and violence. He is irresponsible about his debts, alcoholic, accident-prone, and venereally diseased. It is women's job to domesticate these unruly males. Women transform male lust into love, channel male wanderlust into jobs, homes, and families, change hunters into fathers, divert male will to power into a drive to create. No doubt you can recognize this as an exaggerated version of the Victorian stereotype described in previous chapters. Women equals good, men equals bad, and it's extremely derogatory to men. In Gilder's view, the woman's morality is the ultimate basis for all morality, and men must learn from women. The success or failure of civilized society depends on how well women can transmit these values to men, because clearly they were not created with values. The community is largely what she is and what she demands in men. How is that going to go? That doesn't go well for us, does it? But does God really call women to demand that men lived up to the woman's morality? Or does God call men to live up to God's moral standard? Gilder's fundamental mistake is to assume that it's up to women to take initiative in marriage and family. By contrast, Scripture calls on man to take initiative. Gilder's second mistake is to think men's intrinsic nature is the urge to escape. In order to have a wife and family, he writes, a man must sacrifice his most profound yearning, his bent for the hunt and chase, the motorbike and the open road. But is it really men's most profound yearning to escape, to be predatory, to indulge in immediate gratification? Is that how God really created men? Gilder is letting men off the hook. He is giving them a pass on moral responsibility. Men are allowed to be selfish, lustful, irresponsible, and violent, and then women are tasked with taming their behavior. But if men were really as uncivilized as Gilder portrays them, what woman would have the power to control them? What woman would want to? Both men and women are wired for marriage. That does not mean all people should marry, but it does mean that men do not have to be sacrifice their essential identity in order to marry and raise a family. What they have to sacrifice is their sin and self-centeredness, just as we all do. Colonist William Raspberry wrote an article actually titled Women Training Men. His claim is that crime and drugs among African-American men are not the result of men's own sin and selfish indulgence. They are the fault of African-American women. Why? Because men are naturally prone to irresponsibility, and it's women's job to civilize them. Not working for us at all. The assumption is that marriage is a cultural construction created by women imposed on men. No, it's not. It was created by God. Yet evolutionary psychology tends to be only loosely tied to scientific data. As the saying goes, behavior leaves no fossils. As a result, theories can be freely invented and often are. As Darwinism is discredited scientifically, we should also challenge the way to shape the secular code for the real man. We should refuse to accept an evolutionary script telling us that men are, at the core, brutish and barbarian, that they are flesh-obsessed pigs. From a biblical perspective, we should certainly acknowledge that men are sinful beings, and throughout human history, many have committed rape and violence. But that is not how God created them, and because it's not in their intrinsic nature, they are not locked into it. God's forgiveness and sanctifying power can transform any man to live according to the godly ideal of good man. Biblical view of manhood offers men far greater dignity than any secular view. We should be confident in arguing for it in the public square. We have to be confident to argue for it in the public square. It is not up to the women to do it, but it's up to men and women to restore this
dignity that secularism has robbed men of. One of the world's longest health studies conducted by Harvard University followed a group of men for almost 80 years to find out what made them happy. Researchers discovered the important factor in male happiness and health was not fame, wealth, social class, or professional achievement. Overwhelmingly, the key factor in male mental health was close, loving relationship. Men were created for relationship. Breaks my heart how we have so veered off as the church of what God intended for man and women. Woman, man and woman. It just, and we don't even know it because it's so ingrained in our culture, we don't even recognize what we've missed out on. In the Old Testament, when King David is on his deathbed, he issued a charge to his son Solomon, who is about to succeed him in the throne. So be strong and act like a man. In the next verse, David defines what that phrase means. Observe what the Lord your God requires, walk in obedience to him, and keep his decrees and commands, his laws and regulation. To act like man is to obey God's laws. Of course, the same obedience is required of all genuine followers of God. That's because David is not contrasting man to woman. He's contrasting man to child. He's encouraging Solomon to grow in spiritual maturity. In fact, the phrase continued to mean the same thing right up to the cusp of the modern age. At the turn of the 19th century, explained sociologist Michael Kimmel, the term manhood was synonymous with the term adulthood. To be manly was to accept adult responsibility as provider, producer, and protector of the family. Manhood was opposed to childhood, not to womanhood. Chapter 10, Have We a Religion for Men? How Muscular Christianity Sought to Save Manliness. Yet sports programs are especially important for sending a message that church honors male energy and physicality. Because of testosterone, men tend to be more physically active and competitive, and these are good gifts from God that should be validated. Team sports also draw men to the church by fostering male friendship and camaraderie. Following Christ is not only a matter of what we do in the privatized realm of personal devotion and church activities, it also applies to what we do in the public realm of business and the marketplace. When churches teach that Christianity is a worldview that applies to all of life, the message will be more appealing to men who, after all, spend much of their time working in the public realm. By the earliest 20th century, many American churches had become liberal in their theology. The core of liberal theology was the denial of the supernatural. It rejected the divinity of Christ, the biblical miracles, Jesus' resurrection, and the Bible as divine revelation. As a result, conservative theologians broke off and formed a separate movement. The leading intellectual of fundamentalism, J. Gresham Machen, wrote a book called Liberalism and Christianity, arguing that liberal theology no longer even qualified as a form of Christianity, that it had changed so many central doctrines of historic Orthodox biblical Christianity had become a different religion. The fundamentalists were particularly concerned that theological liberalism was associated with the feminist movement. Liberalism accepted German higher criticism with its core assumption that scripture is not divine revelation, but merely a human document, not the word of God, but only a record of human religious experience. The assumption gave feminists a free hand to discard any interpretation of scripture they disagreed with. As one historian writes, radical feminists received German higher criticism as a gift from heaven because it raised skepticism about the Bible's supernatural origins, which in turn allowed them to reinterpret any passage they find problematic. We were just engaged in a conversation this week where someone chose, or maybe it was last week, where someone chose to say, oh, well, that's not what scripture really means. Like, this is happening in Abilene, Texas. This is happening all over our churches. This is not something far away. This, if you haven't experienced, you're not aware of it, then you need to get your head out of the sand and start recognizing that we're battling through this here now today. Instead of calling men to a higher standard, they began to adopt men's lower standard. The pastor who founded the Baptist Standard was scandalized that even cultivated Christian women were engaging in frivolous and oftentimes sinful indulgences such as drinking, gambling, playing cards, and reading immoral novels. Instead of civilizing men, women had begun to imitate them. Clearly, there should be no double standard in the church. Scripture presents a beautiful balance. Men and women are equally created in the image of God. They are equally sinners, and they equally need God's salvation. The idea that it's women's job to reform men was derogatory to men. Only the Holy Spirit has the power to transform men as well as women. On the other hand, unfortunately, fundamentalists who often went further and began to mirror their surrounding culture in denigrating women as inferior. Just as the secular culture had relegated women to a lower rung on the evolutionary ladder, many fundamentalists likewise began to cast women as inferior to men. So now it's swinging back the other way. One historian summarizes the change as reflected in a magazine articles. By World War II, Moody Monthly articles reflected the new image of God's ideal woman, no longer the Moody Bible Institute graduate wit who uses all her gifts for the kingdom, but the submissive, domesticated woman who knows her place. As Dorothy Sayers writes, the Industrial Revolution took all the productive tasks that women used to perform out of the home and handed them over to big industry to be directed and organized by men at the head of large factories. Even the dairy maid in her simple bonnet is gone to be replaced by a male mechanic in charge of a mechanical milking plant. Men's sphere gained status as the generator of wealth, knowledge, and culture, while women's sphere lost status. In American Women, journalist Gail Collins says, some newspapers started ridiculing housewives as spongers, lazy, and trivial. The devaluation of women's work led to a loss of moral power within the household as well, because women's work was no longer seen as contributing in a significant way to the household economy. Women themselves were treated as having little right to make moral or practical demands on others in the home. For example, to ask their husbands to contribute to parenting and housework. That was labeled as nagging and henpecking. Women, like men, were created to work. That's the message of the cultural mandate. The work of being a mother, of raising children, and managing the home is a wonderful calling, but many women have additional talents and abilities. They were created not only to be fruitful, but also to have dominion over creation. On the other hand, feminism proposes to solve the problem largely by promoting more of the same, by degrading the home yet further and exalting the public sphere as a source of woman's true fulfillment. Yet most families don't want mothers to enter the paid workforce full-time if it means putting young children in some form of substitute care. They don't want father absence to be followed by mother absence. How can these conflicting goals be resolved? Possibly the best solution is to restore income-producing work to the household, to take the colonial era as a model for reintegrating work and home. Chapter 11, Beating Up on Fathers. Why is Dad Always the Dimwit? We can trace the changing role of fathers in literature on parenting. Recall that in the colonial era, most sermons, pamphlets, and child-rearing manuals were addressed to fathers. The assumption was that fathers bore the primary responsibility for education and spiritual formation of their children. But the most striking feature in the parenting literature of the 19th century is the disappearance of references to fathers. For the first time, child-rearing materials began to be addressed exclusively to mothers. For example, a book titled The Care and Feeding of Children did not include a single reference to fathers. A novel titled Coming Through the Rye featured a child narrator who says, I can't think what fathers were invented for. There's no doubt that shared recreation fosters positive father-child bonds. Some of my students say they cherish memories of their father coming home from work and throwing a ball with them in the backyard. Nevertheless, the idea that father was primarily a playmate or buddy was new in the 19th century and entailed a steep loss in status. It contributed to the idea that fathers were not essential to family life. The prevailing theory in psychology today is called attachment theory, and its message is that children thrive only if they form a strong, stable attachment to a caring adult, usually a parent. But social media is so ubiquitous that ever younger children are forming their primary attachment to their peers, even while they're still living at home and even when they have loving, conscientious parents. Peer pressure is alienating children from those who love them most. It is true that committing to marriage and family was part of the male script. A man was not considered mature until he had settled down and started a family. When anthropologist David Gilmore conducted the first ever cross-cultural study of concepts of manhood, he found that virtually all cultures share the expectation that good man performs what he calls the three P's: protect, provide, and procreate, become a father. That's right. Friedan accuses women of domination and aggression for wanting to be homemakers. Ironically, the feminist message aligns squarely with the playboy mentality, which has been another major force in inciting male rebellion. An early Playboy article warned that marriage was a trap that would crush man's adventurous, freedom-loving spirit. The magazine exhorted its readers to enjoy the pleasures the female has to offer without becoming emotionally involved. The very term playboy expressed rebellion. To an earlier generation, it would have been shocking to think that a man should aspire to be a boy, and equally shocking to think that his goal in life should be to play. As one social commentator writes, the arrival of Playboy in 1953 was an all-out rebellion against the requirements of marital duty. Playboy sneered at marriage as the enslavement of men. Playboy is very much, I wouldn't even go there. There's so much connection to Playboy and Hugh Hefner and to the destruction of the innocence of children. Okay, here we go. Playboy sneered, and not for the reasons you think. Playboy sneered at the marriage as enslavement of men. The work of mothers in maintaining the home and rearing children had been so devalued that Playboy expressed contempt for it, accusing homemakers of taking advantage of men by shopping and watching TV all day. The context tells us that Jesus was talking to men. So he's talking about, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. He was talking to men, his male disciples. He was telling men that some truths about spiritual life can be learned only by being attentive to children. A man will sometimes adopt the attitude that taking care of babies and children is drudgery work, suitable for his wife, but not for him. Jesus is challenging that attitude. How can a man learn from his children if he shunts off childcare to his wife? Okay, so that's the last quote from this book, and I just want to wrap it up because it's just got a little bit long, but I hope you can see how we have become so ingrained with the cultural twisting of scripture and our roles that God created for us, even within the church. We don't have to look at the world, just even look within the church, that we have not been living the fullest lives that God offers us. So hopefully this has stepped on your toes a little and made you think a little bit outside the box, because we can't just look at what we've seen happen. We have to go to the original source to figure out what was going on so that we do not continue in the toxic war on masculinity. And so I hope if you don't get to read it, at least you caught some good nuggets from these two parts of The War on Toxic Masculinity by Nancy Piercy. I would love it if you subscribe and share this with your family and friends so we can make sure and get the word out so that we can be a part of bringing life to people, to reestablishing God's kingdom as he designed it, as he created it here in Abilene and the Big Country. Until next time.